This is Fresh Air. I'm Cherry Gross. Between God and Gangster Rap is the name of a new collection of essays by Michael Eric Dyson. The title suggests the position he's in, trying to bridge the different worlds within African-American culture. Dyson is an ordained Baptist minister who is now a professor of communications at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he directs the Institute of African-American Research. One chapter of Dyson's new book is a letter to his younger brother Everett, who is serving a life sentence for a murder he says he didn't commit. Everett has admitted to committing petty crimes in the past, but Michael Eric Dyson believes Everett is innocent of murder. I asked Michael Eric Dyson how his brother has changed over the past 6 years he's been in prison.
Well, I think that he's, first of all, gotten much more deeply spiritual. He's made a change from the Christian faith under which he was reared to a Muslim faith, Moorish temple faith. And he's deeply into his own religious and spiritual pilgrimage toward complete black masculine identity and toward reconstructed sense of who he is as a moral agent and being in the world. We have long intellectual conversations that, quite frankly, we didn't have before he went to prison. We have much more honest exchanges about our feelings, about the family, about how we were reared, about who we are, how we were shaped, and so on. We have more deep discussions about his own responsibility for his family, his children that he have. He has three children, and how he did or did not exercise his own moral responsibility toward them, or even financial obligation toward them before he went to prison, and how now he sees in a much different light his own moral responsibility to them. So we have tremendous frank exchanges about a whole range of subjects.
You're an ordained Baptist minister, and yes. You preached before you became a professor.
Yes, and still do on occasion now. I preach quite frequently, as a matter of fact, on Sundays when people will have me.
Well, how do you feel about your brother having left the Christian faith and become a Muslim?
Well, you know, I think that I feel satisfied that he has found the register and the range of spiritual faith for him that's appropriate. As a Christian minister, there's no question that I preach about my own particular beliefs about God and who God is and so on. But I'm sensitive to the fact that in prison, my brother has come to a sense of who he is through a faith pilgrimage that has made him austere in some instances, but made him more morally reflective, made him more ethically inspired, and given him a sense of purpose in the midst of a hostile and fundamentally inimical condition called prison. And I celebrate that and salute him for that. I also am quite critical of the Baptist Church, in particular of Christian faith in general, in the ways that it has not taken to heart the claim of Jesus Christ to go to prisons and to visit those who are in prison and to reach out to them and to love them, and to minister to them, and to nurture them. The church in which my brother was reared, his own pastor, visited him when he was in jail. But no one from my church visited my brother, despite many calls and from me and other family members, has never visited him once. And I'm embarrassed to say that, but it's the truth. And so that's not something that they alone must take responsibility for. Many churches have not reached out to those who are in prison, whereas the Nation of Islam, the Moorish faith, Moorish temple, Muslim faith, and others have reached out more specifically to redeem and restore black men and to talk about how black masculinity in prisons must be morally reconstructed in order that when these people emerge from prison, they will be useful members of a society where their own talents will be recognized and allowed to shine.
Well, in your new book, you criticize the church for several reasons. You also write that the church has an embarrassing legacy of sexism and misogyny. You say that more than 70% of the black church's members are female, yet women are generally excluded from the church's central station of power, the pulpit.
Yes.
And in fact, when you were a pastor, you presented the idea of ordaining women to the deacon board, and just as the church was preparing an ordination ceremony, you were told to leave.
That's right. The local Baptist Minister Association got caught wind of what I was preparing to do, and I was ordaining them not even as ministers, but just as deacons. And they said this is a transgression of the deepest moral principles of the Baptist faith and the principles by which we have been reared and by which we preach. This person should not be allowed to do that. And on a cold, chilly Sunday morning, I was voted out of my church, given a month's severance pay, given a month to leave, and booted out. And so despite the fact that I love the black church and will continue to devote my life and intellectual energy and imagination to the black church and continue to preach in the black church with its extraordinarily emancipatory legacy, that this other side is just as real, not as powerful, but nasty and negative and nefarious. And I think that that is true, that the question of women in the ministry continues to divide black churches and continues to be an enormous problem, precisely because black women themselves have led the black church for so long, have provided moral, intellectual, spiritual, and even financial and physical support of the church. Every major movement that has emerged within the church that spilled over into the secular world, from abolitionist movements down to the civil rights movement, have been supported by black women. And yet the inability of these black women to find their rightful place as leaders acknowledged within the church is a negative legacy that we have to continue to resist and oppose, and with all of our intellectual and moral might.
Did you get support from women within the church?
I got some support from some women, but I also found a lot of resistance from women. After all, these are the men they have to live with, that they have to love, that they do love. And I understood that. But what was extraordinary to me then as a young pastor, I was in my early 20s, was the degree to which black women had, in my own understanding, been hoodwinked by these black men. It wasn't that simple, of course, but certainly had been seduced by them, had been convinced by them that their best interests lay in other places, that they were not to be concerned about exercising moral authority or leadership within the black church, but that they should be grateful for their own leadership positions as Sunday school superintendent, as usher, in subservient or even service-oriented roles other than the clergy. And I think that that kind of ideological blanketing of the issue, that kind of what Antonio Gramsci would call hegemony, the way in which you seduce people into cooperating with their own oppression and to like it and to ask for more, was operating for me. And I thought it was extraordinary. I thought it was deeply effective, but I thought it was deeply problematic.
I think any time you're asked to leave a position, it's really psychologically upsetting, especially when you're in your 20s and you're just getting started and you're just feeling out who you are professionally and personally. What impact did it have on you when the church asked you to leave?
Yeah, and you're being very kind, because they didn't just ask me, they put me out. I mean, that's the, they asked me to leave, all right. They said, leave, go now. Do not pass, go, get off the board, no more playing. And it was very devastating. I was a young father, a young husband. I had been already asked to leave the school I was attending because I didn't attend enough chapels. So it was a double whammy for me. I'd already been kicked out of undergraduate school at Carson Newman for not attending enough chapels. Ironically, I was pastoring another church then. But it was a protest on my behalf by saying, listen, I'm not going to come to chapel if you don't have but one black speaker a year. The chaplain or some other chapel official replied to me, well, listen, based upon your percentage here at Carson Newman, that's all you deserve per year. So I protested by not going to chapel. I was kicked out of Carson Newman. I then pastored full-time by changing jobs and going to another church. I was kicked out of that church. And I was having problems in my marriage, and my child wasn't obeying me. Boy, I was having a rough day and a rough life at that point. And so it was devastating for me, psychically, emotionally, and even physically. But what it did do, it allowed me to focus my attention upon what I really wanted, and forced me to come to grips with who I was, my professional identity, as well as my own personal and existential goals and ambitions. And what I discovered, Terry, is that I really loved thinking and writing and critically reflecting and engaging in extraordinarily passionate arguments about the nature of truth and what life was about and how we could reflect in popular culture some of the moral principles that African-American churches had nurtured. And so I discovered that my real niche, that the milieu that I wanted to occupy was an intellectual one, was one that allowed me to encourage the life of the mind and engage in the life of the mind without excuse or without sacrifice of my moral principles. So I went back to school and finished my program in philosophy, my undergraduate degree in philosophy, and went on to Princeton to get a PhD. And in an odd way, that church helped me focus my life ambitions and plans upon a larger ministry, upon the ministry of the mind, upon the ministry of the intellect, and to forge a bridge between what I felt in my heart and what I thought in my mind. And so the professorate was a way for me to realize my ambition to engage in the life of the mind.
My guest is Michael Eric Dyson. His new collection of essays is called Between God and Gangster Rap. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Eric Dyson. He directs the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. You write a lot about gangster rap, and there's a lot of gangster rap recordings that you like quite a lot.
Yes.
Do you find that a lot of people see those two worlds, the world of rap music and the world of the church, as being two irreconcilable worlds?
Well, I think that many people do think that those worlds are irreconcilable. But as a person who was reared on the popular culture of black music, I grew up in Detroit during the 60s and 70s when Motown was reigning. And I listened to Smokey Robinson, and I listened to Stevie Wonder. And black popular culture was part and parcel, woof and warp, of my identity. And so I appreciated black popular culture. But I also was reared in the black church, where I heard powerful sermons combining W.E.B. Du Bois with Bertrand Russell and readings of the ancient text, the Bible, with the most powerful intellectual engagement. And so those three worlds operated for me, along with the life of the mind. Those three worlds operated within my own worldview in a very powerful way. So I don't see the kind of irreconcilable contradictions among those worlds. I do see contradictions. I do see disagreements. But what part of my responsibility, I think, as a public intellectual who's been reared in the ghetto of Detroit and who now occupies a relatively privileged spot, both in the church and in the life of the mind in the academy, is to bring those worlds together, to force them to see how they do agree about certain things and how they disagree about other things. For instance, in the black church, the way in which women are treated bespeaks a kind of common understanding of the function of women that operates in gangster rap. Now, it's much more unvarnished. The bigotry, the prejudice, the sexism and patriarchy goes on there in a much more unvarnished way than it does in the church. And yet they agree about the role and responsibility of women in certain fundamental ways. What my responsibility is to bring them in more intimate contact, to force them to see that they have much more in common than they formerly believe, and yet to find a common ground to speak about the issues that they hold in common.
I want to get back to your brother for a moment, who's serving a life sentence for murder. And
yes.
A brother who you believe is innocent of the charge. You're a professor and preacher. Your brother's serving a life sentence in prison for murder.
Yes.
Do you think, and you both grew up in Detroit, in the ghetto. Do you think that the disparity between how your lives are turning out is representative of a larger pattern within black families that are poor in America's inner cities? Do you think it's like representative of a larger pattern showing how one can get out of the ghetto, but on the other hand, how vulnerable one can be?
Sure. It shows that, as well as it shows that I think in some instances those roles can be interchangeable. I mean, I honestly believe that that could be me sitting in a prison, because my brother is a highly intelligent young man, and he's a capable person rhetorically, intellectually, and he has the ability, I think, to operate in a much different circle than the one in which he's operated so far. Now, that doesn't mean that I didn't, engage in hard work and take seriously and to heart the work ethic that my father drummed into both of our heads and hearts, and that my mother did as well. And so it doesn't fully account for why my brother ends up in prison and I ended up in Princeton or as a professor. What it does suggest to me, however, are the very, thin lines that divide black men and black women who are successful from those who are less successful. That the arbitrary nature of some of the power that's exercised against poor people's lives affect one brother one way and another brother another way. I don't want to ascribe all of the differences to just sheer chance or arbitrary power. I do want to suggest that people have to make their own way and have to take responsibility for their own lives, by the way, which is promoted by my family and most other poor families that I'm aware of. On the other hand, it does suggest and bespeak an enormous tension in many poor black families, where some brothers and sisters are successful and others aren't, and how do we make sure that more are successful while less are less successful? And one of the ways we do that, I think, Terry, is by learning to encourage early on young black kids and Latino kids and Asian kids and other kids that are poor and white kids who are poor, encourage them to allow their talents to shine, because I think luck often allows talent to shine. The question is, how can we deal with some of the more powerful forces that operate in people's lives, like economic misery, like material deprivation, like class prejudice, that discourage some more than it discourages others? There's no question that I think that my brother was more discouraged by some of the barriers that were put up before him than I was. That was not sheer chance or luck, and it wasn't by the fact that I was better than he was. I think that I was early on encouraged to realize my talent, which might have been more evident than my brother's, but my brother's was just as real.
I want to end with a thought that comes from your book, Between God and Gangster Rap. You write, the goal should not be to transcend race, but to transcend the biased meaning associated with race.
Yes.
I want you to elaborate on that thought for us.
Well, what I mean by that, I don't want to have to genuflect or bow down at the shrine of a superior American identity that is neutral or bland or all-inclusive, that makes minorities, or whether ethnic or racial or sexual, believe that unless they cleanse the particular strains and strands of their race, whether they're Italian or whether they're Irish or whether they're African-American or Latino or Latina, to make them feel that unless they transcend the particular embodiment of their racial or ethnic identity, they can't really be Americans. I don't want to denigrify myself. I don't want to de-African-Americanize myself. I believe that I can bring all of the accoutrements of my identity to bear upon my career and profession and my goals in life, and yet still be acknowledged as an American. And what it is to be an American is to have all of that come together.
Now, let me get to the second half of that sentence about transcending the biased meaning associated with race.
Well, what that means is that so many black people believe, because of the vicious stereotypes that prevail, the biased meanings associated with their own racial identity, that they have to stop being black in order to be accepted. I hear black people all the time say, I don't want to be white or black, I want to be, you know, a human being. Well, I got news for you. When you were born black, you were born human. White Americans often aren't invited to see the distinction between their own humane identity, human identity, and their racial identity, because they're assumed to be universal. Whiteness is a universal identity in American culture. Most other identities are not. So African Americans often find themselves dealing with transcending the biased meanings associated with race by trying to transcend racial identity in general. I think those are two different things. You don't have to stop being black in order to be American. You don't have to stop being black in order to be human. And I think that this country has not accepted the fact that you don't have to stop being black in order to be an American. And many black people haven't. Look at O.J. Simpson. Here's the perfect example of a man who felt that he had to blanch his own black identity in an ocean of whiteness in order to succeed. And what I want to see happen is that you can be a black man, you can be a black woman, you can be a Latino man and woman, and still be an American. What we have to overcome are the negative biases and the stereotypes associated with Latino identity, with black identity. That's what we have to transcend, not black identity, just the negative stereotypes that prevail about black identity.
Michael Eric Dyson, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very kindly.
Michael Eric Dyson's new collection of essays is called Between God and Gangster Rap. He directs the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is Fresh Air.